Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco News Report, an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, Eco News. You can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. I'm Ken Burton, and my guest this week is Sharon Levy, a science writer based here in Arcata. Regular KHSU listeners will recognize her name because she's a longtime sponsor of the station. We're going to be talking about the subject of her recent book, Once and Future Giants, What Ice Age Extinctions Tell Us About the Fate of Earth's Largest Animals. Sharon, welcome to the studio.
Hi, glad to be here.
First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
I learned a lot from it. It's about big animals of the past, present, and future. These animals are referred to collectively as megafauna. What's the technical definition of that term?
Most scientists who study megafauna would define that to include any animal species that weighs 100 pounds, at least 100 pounds as an adult. So that includes people.
Most of us, yep.
Yeah.
As your book explains, most of the world's really big land mammals died out towards the end of the Pleistocene. And there are two competing theories as to why that happened.
That's right. The more conventional theory that held sway for a long time was that these large animals, which are called megafauna, died out as a result of climate change. And in North America, the evidence is that all these large animals, there were several different kinds of native elephant, there were ground sloths, these amazing big tank-like vegetarians that could stand up as tall as an elephant on their hind legs.
Anyone who's watched the Ice Age film series has at least a cartoonish idea of what these things may have been.
A cartoonish idea, yes. There were saber-toothed cats, which, again, you get a cartoonish idea from that Ice Age movie. But there were this whole array of very large, impressive mammals. And in North America, they all died out about 13,000 years ago. And this was a time when the glaciers were receding at the end of the last ice age. And so the original theory was that they had all died out because the climate was warming so rapidly and their habitats changed so quickly that they couldn't adapt. And the alternative theory was brought up mostly by a guy named Paul Martin, who was a paleontologist.
Interesting character.
Yes. I was very lucky. I got to meet him a couple of years ago. He passed away last fall. But I'm very glad I got to meet him. He was very charismatic, just like the megafauna he was into. But his theory was that Clovis people, which are a very distinctive early American culture that left behind these very big, elegant stone spear points that were shaped like leaves. And the spear points were found among the bones of mammoths and mastodons that were scattered all across the continent. Mm-hmm. And Martin put forward the theory that since Clovis people seemed to have spread all across North America in that same window of time, 13,000 years ago, that they were the culprits, that they pushed all these megafauna into extinction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because we, you know, most of us kind of grow up with this notion of pre-industrial peoples living in harmony with their environments. And, you know, what Martin suggested is that these people at very low population levels with very primitive technologies did a tremendous amount of damage.
That's right. And when he first brought up this idea, he first brought this up publicly in the late 1950s when he was a postdoc. And he got a lot of good laughs out of his colleagues. Basically, no one took him seriously at first. They said, this is just absurd that people with Stone Age technology could drive all these large animals into extinction. But one of the interesting things about Martin was that he never particularly cared what anybody thought.
Very liberating.
Yeah. And when I met him, he said, well, I like an idea that goes way out on the end of the limb and sees how long it can hang there. So his parts of his theory, which he himself called the Blitzkrieg theory, the idea that these Clovis people were the very first people in America, which, by the way, we now know is not the case. But in Martin's day, when he was developing this theory, that was really believed to be so. So his idea, his vision was that these people came across the Bering Land Bridge from Asia and that they were Mondo big game hunters and had been killing woolly rhinos and woolly mammoths on their way across. And they found themselves in North America, which was a tremendous menagerie of naive large animals that had never seen a person before. And in his vision, they just slaughtered their way from coast to coast in an incredibly quick time. I would say there's a lot of points about his theory that did fall off the branch over the decades since he brought it up. But the core idea that humans played a significant role in those extinctions, it has hung on. That's still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a good way to phrase it, played a significant role, and maybe in concert with larger events such as climate change. My impression is that that's the conclusion that you've reached. Perhaps these populations were kind of pushed into corners in some areas, at least, by climate change, and humans helped push them over the edge. And then, of course, we could make the argument that climate change facilitated human occupation of the continent as well. So directly or indirectly,
yes,
climate change does seem to have played a role.
That's very true. So the theory that makes most sense to me now, and that's come to dominate in the last few years, really after Martin had retired from his professional career, is a kind of 1-2 punch theory. And it's what you were mentioning. The idea is that the megafauna were stressed by rapid climate change and that the amount of habitat available to them became fragmented into small islands. And that in that condition where they were under stress and their populations were reduced, that human hunters were able to have a much more powerful impact than you would expect. And there's some very interesting evidence that that's true.
Yeah, and that brings up a part of the book that I found particularly fascinating, is some of the techniques that people are using to explore these different theories and the causes behind these events that happened so long ago. It's a field called forensic paleontology. And yeah, the whole dung mold spore thing I found very, very intriguing. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Okay. Well, there are these very dramatic sites, as I mentioned, with Clovis spear points embedded in the bones of some mammoths and mastodons and extinct bison. But there's also a much humbler approach that can be very revealing. And that's really come into use just in the past few years. And what paleontologists are doing with that is there's a specific kind of fungus that only grows in the dung of large vegetarian animals. It's called Sporomyela. That's the Latin name. And they are able to go to places where things like plant pollen and fungal spores are really well preserved. One example of a scientist I visited who was doing this was he was working in boggy places in the Hudson River Valley in New York. And he would take a great big auger and dig, 14 feet below the surface, and he'd get down to a layer that was from the era of the last mastodons. And he was able to show by counting the number of these dung fungus spores in the different layers that there's a moment at about 14,000 years ago when the amount of dung fungus just plummets in New York. And very soon after that, the amount of charcoal in the layers goes way up. And his argument is that the earliest Americans in New York really drove a decline in the megafauna populations, and that then when these people started to light landscape fires, which hunter-gatherer peoples around the world have always done, that the landscape fires became much more intense because there was fuel buildup because you didn't have a whole array of sloths and mastodons and whatnot munching up the vegetation anymore.
And we're still fighting fuel buildup 10,000 years later.
We sure enough are.
Yeah. And then the growth rings in the mastodon tusks, I thought, was also really fascinating.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. There's a very interesting researcher, Dan Fisher, who's a paleontologist at University of Michigan. And he sort of invented this whole field of endeavor and taught himself to do it over the last 30 years. And it started sometime in the early 80s. He was called to a place where a tractor had accidentally crashed into a mastodon skeleton. And when he was called to the site, he went out there and he saw that there were these light and dark rings across a cross-section of the tusk. And he said, aha, those must be growth rings. I bet I could get a lot of information out of this. And over the years, he's taken this to an incredibly refined level where he's looking at growth rings in mammoth and mastodon tusks on a microscopic scale. And from studying variations in these growth rings, he can tell all kinds of things. He can tell when one of these ancient elephants was pregnant or nursing. He can tell what time of year it was when they died. He can tell how old they were when they died. And from looking at the patterns in a whole array of mastodon tusks, what he found was during the last 2,000 years that the species existed in North America, the age of puberty in mastodons went way down. So at the beginning of that time, they were becoming sexually mature when they were about 13. The end of that time, they were becoming sexually mature when they were only 10. And that pattern fits with an array of studies on all kinds of creatures, from fish all the way up to elephants, that show when populations experience heavy predation, then individuals will start to become sexually mature at a younger age. And it's a strategy that gives them a better shot at reproducing before they get hunted down. So that suggests that there was serious hunting pressure. And Fisher believes that it was human hunting in addition to all the pressure from American lions and American cheetahs and saber-toothed cats.
Whereas the opposing theory, if climate change were responsible, we'd likely see a reduced reproductive rate.
Exactly. In modern elephants, when people have studied modern elephant populations and they're going through a time of drought and hunger, which would be the scenario if climate change was the driving factor, in that situation, elephants will delay their age of mating and reproduction. They're kind of waiting out the bad times, waiting for better conditions, so they'll have a better chance of raising that calf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty compelling evidence, I think. Although, again, probably not 100%, one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, failing a time machine being invented, I don't think we can ever know exactly, but there's a lot.
I have a lot of faith in technology, but not that much.
Yeah. Me too either. But it is really intriguing. And one of the things that was great about doing this book was I got to go hang out with the researchers who do this, and I got to hold the gut contents of a 25,000-year-old mastodon in
Yum.
My hand. Yeah. I mean, people say yuck, but it was a thrill to me.
Yeah. No, I can relate. And so I want to mention that this sort of evidence crops up in many parts of the world other than North America that implicate humans as the causative factors behind these extinctions. But unfortunately, we aren't going to have time to venture out of North America much today. This is the Econews Report. I'm Ken Burton, and I'm speaking with Sharon Levy about megafaunal extinctions. So, lest anybody think this is a purely academic argument, why does it matter how these species disappeared?
Why it matters is that the same kind of 1-2 punch that seems to have done in mammoths and mastodons and sabertooths and all those other amazing animals, the 1-2 punch of rapid climate change and pressures from an increasing human population are playing out right now at a much, much intensified level. So right now, because of human-made greenhouse gases, the rate of warming is faster than it has been in the known evolution of mammals, so for millions of years. And at the same time, we have become so dominant on the planet that we have greatly reduced the amount of habitat that's available to large animals. So in practical terms, there are two big sort of schools of thought about how understanding those ice age extinctions can help with conservation of living animals. And the first one is, I don't think anyone would argue about it, it's about habitat connectivity. And I'm sure a lot of folks who listen to the Eco News know what this is about. It's habitat corridors that allow animals to move from one island of habitat to the other so they don't become isolated. And there's a drive for that going on in Africa and in the Americas. In some ways, I think they've gone farther in Africa because they do have some transboundary conservation areas that are designed to keep elephant populations healthy. So they're pieces of land that overlap Mozambique, South Africa, Tanzania, they're all working together. And here in North America, people are working on projects like Yellowstone to Yukon, trying to keep a corridor open.
Yeah, here we are facing an even bigger suite of extinctions and clearly playing a very large part. in that process. So aside from their just generally charismatic nature, why are megafauna so important in ecosystems? What happens when they disappear?
Megafauna really shape the habitats they live in to an extent that surprised me when I started to research this. To start with the vegetarians, let's take elephants, because
elephants come up a lot in your book.
Yes. They're not descendants of the mammoths and mastodons. They're cousins, and they were contemporary. They all lived at the same time, but the elephants in Africa and Asia are the only ones that survived. And something that's very clear from studies of elephants in Africa is that they create habitat for a whole suite of other large animals. So elephants are big enough to go in and break up acacia trees and munch up the branches. And research has shown that there's a kind of elephant-driven cycle on the African savanna, where elephants over time, especially when they go through a time of drought, will crunch up trees, knock them back, and open up habitat where more grass can grow. And following that whole process, you'll see an influx of smaller megafauna like megafauna and zebra that follow the elephants and go where the grass is growing. And the Maasai people in Africa, who domesticated cattle about 9,000 years ago, have for many thousands of years been following elephants and following wildebeest and following zebra in order to feed their cattle, because there are droughts every year in that part of the world, and those megafauna know where the good habitat is. But in places where the elephants are being excluded, that whole process is grinding to a halt.
And yeah, and similar sorts of ripple effects are seen, of course, in all over the world where large animals have been removed from the system.
Yeah.
And the term that I learned, and I think you mentioned it in the book, is trophic cascades.
Right. Trophic cascades are really important in understanding megafauna. And one of the most dramatic examples comes from here in the U.S. And it's a trophic cascade that took place when wolves were wiped out from Yellowstone country. The last wolf was deliberately hunted out there in the 1920s. And then for several decades, there were no wolves. And the elk population boomed. And following this great boom in the elk population, there were a lot of trees that grow along stream sides, riparian trees like alders and cottonwood, that just were failing to grow any new trees in their population. The old ones were there, but no young ones were able to grow up because the elk were devouring them. Well, when the wolves were brought back to Yellowstone in 1995, it was a fantastic opportunity to study the effect of bringing this large predator back. And the results that have been found are really very dramatic. So not only have wolves in Yellowstone, they've lowered the elk population, although it took several years for that to happen. But I think even more important than lowering the number of elk in Yellowstone,
modifying their behavior.
They changed the elk's behavior. The elk are a lot more wary, and they know that wolves like to hunt along stream courses. And so they're starting to avoid stream courses, except when they really need a drink. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there's a lot of new growth of alder and cottonwood and willow. And this creates a whole chain reaction. Beavers have been able to reestablish in Yellowstone as they use those riparian plants to build their dams. Mm-hmm. And when beavers create dams, that creates habitat for a whole range of creatures that had been disappearing.
Mm-hmm. All the way down to small birds and rodents.
Yeah, the ponds, you know, insects and amphibians need the ponds. There are songbirds that only nest in willow of a certain age, and those birds have been disappearing. Mm-hmm. And with the young willow coming back, you get those birds back nesting in the park.
Yeah. And then there's also another phenomenon that occurs, mesopredator release.
Right.
There's examples of that all over the place, especially with coyotes and some of the weasel-type animals just exploding when the top predators are removed, and
right.
That hammers the lower end of the food chain.
Right, and there's also a dramatic example of that from Grand Teton National Park, which is just south of Yellowstone, where the coyote population, from this long absence of wolves, it had a tremendous coyote population. And there's a threatened population of pronghorn
right.
that live
they summer in the Tetons, and in the snow they have to go to a lower elevation, and they have a migration of 100 and some miles, which has now become a real obstacle course of energy development. Mm-hmm. And
natural gas mostly.
Yeah. But when the wolves came back in the small area where wolves have moved south out of Yellowstone into the Tetons, the wolves keep the coyotes really minimized, and the fawns, the pronghorn fawns, survive, where in areas where you don't have wolves around, the coyotes tend to get all the pronghorn fawns.
I'm Ken Burton, and my guest today is Sharon Levy, the author of Once and Future Giants. Sharon, these extinctions, obviously the ones that haven't happened yet, people are trying hard to prevent them from happening, and maybe there are more ways to do that than are being done so far. But there may even be ways of reversing the effects of extinctions that already have happened, if not the extinctions themselves. Let's talk about that with the little time we have left.
Okay. There are a few wacky people out there who would like to recreate the mammoth, and since we're short on time, I won't go into that other than to say it's pretty fantastical and impractical for a number of reasons. But there is also a growing cadre of conservation ecologists who are advocating what they call Pleistocene rewilding. And what they mean is that where there is an ecological niche that's standing empty from an extinction, that we may be better off bringing in an exotic substitute species than struggling along with nothing at all in that niche in the ecosystem. So there's a great example of that on the island of Mauritius. On the island of Mauritius, the island was not disturbed by humans until the 1600s, when some Dutch sailors found the place and proceeded to settle it. And within decades of the humans showing up there, all the large seed-eating animals on the island had been driven to extinction. So there was the dodo, one of the most famous.
The classic.
Yeah.
Extinction.
The icon of human-driven extinction. And there were also two species of giant tortoise and a giant lizard. And all these animals ate large fruits. And these fruits come from native plants that exist only on Mauritius, nowhere else. And they tend to produce their fruits low on their trunks, right at the height that a dodo or a giant tortoise would be able to reach. And in present-day Mauritius, long after these animals were driven extinct, there are native plants that are barely hanging on. And despite extreme conservation efforts, these plants aren't reproducing. Well, a guy named Dennis Hansen went in and did an experiment where he fed the fruits of these endangered plants to some captive Aldabra tortoises. They're a giant tortoise from a different island chain. And he was able to show that by passing the seed through a tortoise, you can produce a much more robust, healthier seedling. And this is a phenomenon that's pretty well known in tropical ecology, that fruiting plants have co-evolved with the animals that eat their fruits and disperse their seeds. And without these large animals to eat the fruits and spread them around, get them out from under the canopy of the parent plant, and deposit them in a nice fertile heap of poo for them to grow in, these native plants were fading away. But if you reverse the process by bringing in the Aldabra tortoise, as they've shown on a small island off the coast of Mauritius, a little islet, they let Aldabra tortoises loose there starting in 2000, and there's a booming population, and they've brought back a nearly extinct ebony plant.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the whole idea of introducing exotic species in the present day and age, you know, just sends chills up a lot of people's spines, as it should. And the one advantage to these big animals is that they're perhaps more easily managed than introducing some insect biological control agent or something like that. And I envision maybe game ranches, large fenced game ranches, as being a realistic testing ground for these sorts of things?
Well, the initial public proposal for Pleistocene rewilding was an opinion piece that came out in the journal Nature in 2005. And the pitch in that piece was to bring African lions and elephants and cheetahs and put them in enclosed game ranches. The hitch with that is that even in very large parks, like Kruger National Park in South Africa, where one of the largest surviving elephant population lives. Elephants overpopulate really quickly. Yeah. So you can't really do megafauna in a small enclosed space. It's not practical. I think that the folks behind Pleistocene Rewilding, they have some good points. But I have to say, when I first heard about it, I thought they were cuckoo. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea, you know, like the African lion, it's a total deal breaker.
Sure, it'll never happen. Humans will always have to play the role of top predator here, I think. I mean, except for, you know, the wolf introduction notwithstanding. We're not going to have lions running around North America.
Yeah.
But to go back to modifying animals' behavior, you made one point in your book that it maybe doesn't always matter so much what is there as much as how it's managed, and that we could do a lot to bring back some of the way things used to work just by managing our livestock differently than we do.
Yes, we could. And that's been shown too in some studies that compare the impacts of bison versus domesticated cattle mm-hmm. on the range. And really, if you manage domestic cattle so that they're acting more like bison, that is, instead of parking in one small place and overgrazing it, they're moving across the range, following the flush of fresh grass as the season progresses, and not overgrazing, they can actually increase biodiversity on the plains just like bison do.
Yeah. Well, this is a really fascinating subject. We've just scratched the surface, but I'm afraid we are out of time. So just before I let you go, though, what are you working on now?
I'm working on some articles for science magazines, and I'm writing my first novel. So.
Wow. Cool. All right. Thanks for coming in, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name's Ken Burton, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today has been Sharon Levy, and we've been talking about megafaunal extinctions, why they happen, why they matter, and how we can prevent them. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the audio archives page at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 707-826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.